I've devoted a lecture to Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, talking chiefly about the king and the prince and Hotspur. I barely mentioned Falstaff. He requires more space. He takes more space. Falstaff is probably Shakespeare's most enduringly popular creation. Certainly, he was mentioned more often in contemporary comment on Shakespeare's plays than any other character that Shakespeare created. And nowadays, he is argued over at least as often as Hamlet. He is not only one of the great creations in the drama of the English-speaking peoples. Like Hamlet, he has taken on a life independent of the plays, become a figure in the mental world of English-speaking peoples. He's an intensely significant character. In this lecture, I'm going to be interpreting a lot, probing the meaning of his actions and his words. But I do not want Falstaff himself to disappear amid a fine-spun web of abstract intellectualizing, a web of commentary. I don't want to get too far away or let you forget the physical presence of the man. Shakespeare never gets too far away from it. His words, what others say of him, and above all, the physical presence of the man, never let us escape from the central fact about Falstaff on the stage. The central fact is that he is fat. Not plump, not chubby, not portly, but corpulent, stout, rotund, obese, fat. To use Shakespeare's own words, he is a bedpresser, a huge hill of flesh, a greasy tallow catch. His belly is as gross as a mountain, open, palpable. When hast thou last seen thy knee? In the center of this intensely political play, there is a stuffed cloak bag of guts who eats, drinks, sleeps, and snores, and has no politics. At the center of the body politic, the state, the human organization devised to fill our collective needs, is the human body itself. Now, this fat figure has various theatrical sources. Note theatrical, not historical. When I wrote a book about the real history behind Shakespeare's history plays, I barely mentioned Falstaff. Falstaff is largely an invented character coming out of theatrical traditions. And it's useful in understanding him to understand what those traditions were and how Shakespeare has adapted them. I'll mention 4 in particular. There is the vice from the medieval morality plays. The morality plays were allegorical plays in which a representative figure, youth or mankind, was tempted by vices and encouraged by virtues. Often the vices were reduced to a single vice with a capital V, whose job it was to ensnare youth, to lead youth on to idleness, gluttony, lechery, and so forth, and to embody those sins himself. In fact, Hal calls Falstaff a vice, a reverend vice, a gray iniquity, a father ruffian, a vanity in years. Now, the terms are all paradoxical. Vice, iniquity, ruffian, vanity, those are all terms for the vice. But to have him reverend or gray or father or in years old, that's unusual. The vice is usually young. Henry IV uses the pattern of the old morality plays, presenting a young man, in this case Prince Hal, being tempted by an embodiment of the world, the flesh, and the devil. The pattern is used, but it is also modified. Hal, after all, is not deceived. It's he who calls Falstaff those names. In the normal morality play, youth does think that the vice is telling him something good to do. Isn't it fun to be slothful, drunken, lecherous, and so forth? Hal is perfectly well aware of what is going on. What is significant is the effect that Falstaff could have on Hal. Certainly, this is the effect that the king thinks that Falstaff is having on Hal, but the relationship is not developed in the strict morality way. The second source comes from ancient Roman comedy, the Miles Gloriosus, the boastful soldier, the soldier who comes into the city proclaiming how many countries he has conquered, how many provinces he has sacked, how many maidens he has raped, full of his own exploits. Usually, he has actually done these things. Sometimes he has not. Well, Falstaff is this kind of braggart soldier who boasts about his military exploits. You must remember that he is a knight. He is Sir John Falstaff. At some point, someone in authority thought he had done something distinguished on a battlefield and hence given him that knighthood. But in the case of Falstaff, the adaptation is that it is all lies, all exaggerations. A more important adaptation is that the ancient Roman Miles Gloriosus was a deadly serious figure. He expected to be taken at his own merit, at his own claim for military glory. Falstaff makes the claim, but it is never clear whether he really means people to believe it. In fact, some of the stories he tells about his exploits are quite unbelievable, and he's far too smart to think that people would believe them. Third source, also from classical comedy and from classical life itself, the parasite or sycophant, the hanger-on who leeches onto other people and lives off them, a very common social phenomenon in a hierarchically organized society where it's more difficult for people to go out and find jobs. They have to attach themselves as servants or functionaries to great people who have much land and possession and hope they can make themselves useful and get paid for it. The parasite from classical comedy also turns up in Elizabethan comedy as a sponger, a trickster, a mocker, and these things Falstaff does. He never pays his own bills at the tavern. Hal pays him for them. Or Mistress Quickly just hopelessly goes on adding to the tab, knowing that she'll never get paid. But again, there's a modification. Falstaff is not totally a taker. He also gives. He entertains. He's the sort of man whom you don't mind paying the bill in the tavern for because he was such fun at the tavern. While you were drinking all that stuff that you are paying for, he was telling the funniest stories going. And the fourth and last source for the time being is the fool, the court jester. He is the prince's jester. And the jester exists to divert the lord, prince, king, whom he serves, with verbal wit, dexterity, verbal games, comic inventions, pranks, and so forth. In this case, however, it isn't merely fantasy that he's entertaining the prince with. For much that Falstaff says is quite true. Much of it embodies a quite accurate criticism of the great people around, of kings and lords and princes and the commonwealth. Falstaff is thus a paradoxical figure. Yes, you could say he is vicious, he is a vice, but he's also tonic. He is life-enhancing. Yes, he's parasitical, but he's generous. Yes, he tells lies, but he doesn't expect to be believed. Yes, he exploits his friends, but they still love him. Yes, he laments his age, his clumsiness, and particularly his bulk, his fatness. And yet he is extraordinarily nimble and quick. Nimble and quick mentally. Light on his mental feet. He is a lord of misrule. He presides at the tavern as surely as King Henry presides at the court at Westminster. And Hotspur presides in the camp of the rebels out in the battlefield. In fact, he deliberately mocks that kind of sitting in state. There's a scene, the great tavern scene in Henry IV, Part 1, the end of Act 2, where he pretends to be the king momentarily and takes, he enthrones himself in a wooden chair and puts a cushion on his head to represent the king's crown. As Lord of Misrule, he advocates the good life. Pleasure is more important than work. Idleness is more fun than industry. Enjoying oneself is more important than satisfying others or worrying about the future or taking care for the welfare of the state, honor, and politics. The chief means by which he does these things is to turn everything upside down, to invert the normal order of things. Let me take one example from the tavern scene I've already mentioned at the end of Act Two. This tavern scene follows upon a highway robbery that Hal, Falstaff, Poyne, Bardolph, Nim, and the rest of the crew have carried out on Gad's Hill. Only it's been a highway robbery with a twist. Hal and Poynes deliberately separated themselves from Falstaff and the others, let Falstaff and the others rob the merchants who were going to Canterbury, or coming from Canterbury, I've forgotten which, of their money, and then in disguise set upon Falstaff and Bardolph and company and robbed them. Therefore, when Falstaff comes back to the tavern, supposedly having carried out this robbery, although having been deserted by Hal and Poynes, he's got to account for the lack of money. Where's the dough? He has to say something. So he starts by picking on the faults of Hal and Poynes. You are cowards. What did you do? Why weren't you there to help us? And then he expands the account of the robbery into a magnificent story. A story about how they did indeed carry out the robbery, but then they were set upon by others and robbed in turn. They were set upon by two buckram men. And as he fought them, he took four of their points in his target. They're suddenly four buckram men, and they go on multiplying to seven buckram men and 11 buckram men, and finally, he would have beaten even the 11 buckram men had not three misbegotten knaves in Kendall Green attacked him from behind. Now, he's doing several things here. He is escaping a tough situation, telling a wonderful and fantastic story. This is an essential part of the comedy of Falstaff. He's an escape artist. Our delight in him is in the ingenious methods of avoiding or extricating himself from an awkward spot. He was the one who ran away during the Gad's Hill robbery when Hal and Poynes set on them disguised, but he reverses the cowardice accusation to attack them. And he tells this story, which nobody is going to believe, and that itself attracts so much attention, is so amusing, that people can forget about the initial problem. He gets out of an awkward spot, not with the direct valor and quarrelsomeness of Hotspur, who of course would fight his way out with a sword, and not with the anxious planning of King Henry, who has reckoned on all contingencies, and arranged backup plans for any emergency, or with the long-range strategy of Prince Hal that I was talking about in the previous lecture. Instead, he gets out of awkward situations with spontaneous inventiveness, with improvisation. He is, to adapt a modern form, a stand-up comedian who can talk his way out of any situation. By this means, by this improvisation, he creates holiday. He creates carnival. The world is a serious business, an anxious business where kings must meet rebellions, an insecure place. Falstaff considers the world to be a game, a revel. Once they get through the buckram men section of this great tavern scene, in comes a messenger from the court, Sir John Bracy, to bring the news of the rebellion. The king wants the prince to turn up at court. The prince has got to help in meeting the rebellion, and obviously the king is going to rebuke the prince for his wastrel behavior. So Falstaff takes that situation and turns it into another game. Hey, Hal, you are going to be horribly rebuked tomorrow. What are you going to say to your father? Hey, let's practice it. Let's have a little tea group session in which I pretend to be the king, and I'll rebuke you, and you answer for yourself. And then they switch roles. The prince takes the role of his father, and Hal answers for Falstaff. They turn it into a play of its own. Falstaff is really a mythical figure, a god of physical pleasures and a god of imaginative pleasures, a Saturnalian figure who presides over our merrymaking. We all feast at the Boar's Head Tavern from time to time in our lives. We all pay homage to this particular kind of Bacchus god, and Falstaff embodies him enormously. He embodies him because he acts so well. This is all varieties of acting, the improvisation, the lies, the entertainment. He is supposedly leading Hal astray. He accuses Hal of leading him astray. At Gad's Hill, young men on a spree, oppressed by an older generation. He himself is old, but he says of the merchants, they hate us, youth. In the tavern, he is the courageous, stalwart man, vexed by the cowardice of his friends who left him to fight alone against 11 buckram men. And on the battlefield, where things get really serious finally at the end of part one, he turns out to have in his holster not a gun, but a bottle of sack. And he plays dead in order to stay alive. Those soldiers running around there, the Earl of Douglas and Hotspur, they're far too dangerous. And he just flops down and pretends to be a corpse in order to continue living. This is the strangest fellow, says Hal to his brother Prince John at the end of the play. And he's strange partly because he can act so well. He can shift roles so rapidly. He is Quicksilver, which is all the more surprising in a fat man. He's never the same thing for more than a few minutes, always resourceful, always chameleonic, always shifting that huge hill of flesh into a new shape, and even remolding it into the ideal shape of himself. When he is pleading to Hal not to be rejected in that game where Hal is playing the king and he is playing Hal, he talks about this, the virtues of this man, Falstaff. Banish your other bad companions. By all means, banish Peto, banish Bardolph, banish Poins. But for sweet Jack Falstaff, kind Jack Falstaff, true Jack Falstaff, valiant Jack Falstaff, and therefore the more valiant being as he is, old Jack Falstaff, banish not him thy Harry's company. Banish not him thy Harry's company. Banish plump Jack and banish all the world. That's a wonderful metamorphosis, to take the fatness, the huge hill of flesh, and make it sweet, true, and merely plump. You banish that, you banish all the world. Hal, of course, is willing to do it. His very quiet response to that speech is, I do. I will. Which brings us back to the confrontation between Hal and Falstaff. My ultimate goal in this lecture. We can criticize Falstaff. We can criticize him for being detached from serious concerns. In essence, Falstaff is asking, what's so important about a well-run state? Why spend all this fuss and concern about who wears the crown? What does it matter so long as we have food and drink? What does it matter if we get good soldiers? He abuses the draft. There are several scenes in which he does it, one offstage in part one, but one onstage in part two, which is much more striking, where he allows all the hearty, strong men to buy their way out of the draft and takes instead the weak, the ragged, the sickly. But why not have the weak and the ragged and sickly? If the people going to the war are going to get killed, they'll fill a pit as well as others. Let the healthy ones survive. Why on earth do you worry so much about honor? Falstaff is utterly without principle. You cannot really call him a liar, a coward, a thief, an abuser of the draft, a sponge on Mistress Quickly, as I have been saying he is, or make any of the other moral objections that spring naturally to the moralist's lips, because he doesn't share the principles that would validate such charges. He calls into question the very existence of principle itself. Eat, drink, and be merry. Act your way through. Now, that is what Hal must object. And that is why there is a great confrontation between the two at the end of part two of Henry IV. Let me generalize here about what is going on. I said part of this would get quite intellectual. Hal is a leader, a prince who has designed a career that will lead him to the crown. What do we want in a leader? Well, justice, perhaps mercy, competence, efficiency, effectiveness, inspiration when necessary, the ability to inspire us to our best abilities. Above all, I think, devotion to duty. We want him to be concerned with our protection, with our welfare, to be absorbed in that task, to take on the burden. And it's a big burden. This is the play where the king has the most famous line Shakespeare ever wrote for any king, "Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown." We want the king to be forethoughtful and industrious and resourceful and shrewd and devoted to the job. And Hal eventually proves to be so. As a Renaissance prince, he proves to be as devoted to his duty in the world, as devoted as any medieval man might be devoted to a religious vocation. Now, I make that comparison because I am following the instruction of an old professor of mine, now retired, Robert Hunter, who would put the contrast between Hal and the prince in context of the whole growth of the early modern world, the growth of Puritanism, and the growth of capitalism. He urged me when we first talked about Hal, Falstaff, and the King to read Max Weber, to read the book The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, and think about it in terms of, think about the play in the terms provided by Weber. Weber points out that the Protestant ethic is essentially a notion of worldly asceticism, labor in the worldly sphere, labor on a career in the world, be it business or government, with the intensity and devotion that the Middle Ages had brought to the religious life, to the monastic life. Weber saw the heart of the Protestant ethic in Luther's idea of the calling. You may cease to be a monk, you may abolish the monasteries, but you do not abolish the worth of asceticism, of self-denial that lies within monasticism. Rather, he transferred that dedication from the monastery to the affairs of the world. Duty in worldly affairs is the highest form of moral activity that an individual could assume. You labor in your vocation. You are devoted to public welfare. You postpone personal gratifications. You pay the debt you never promised, to use Prince Hal's phrase. In the four centuries since Puritanism stamped its distinctive mark on Western culture, particularly Anglo-Saxon culture, English-speaking culture, we have tried, many of us, to raise our children in this way. Hal's version of the Protestant ethic is unusual only in that he appears to be a wastrel at first. He really has this Protestant scheme of devotion to his job going all the time. When he becomes king, then it becomes apparent that he has been embodying dutiful devotion all the time. In this context, Falstaff is everything that the Protestant ethic is not. He eats and drinks and is merry. He takes no thought for the morrow. He mocks every serious value in the culture: honor, valor, truthfulness. He parodies the idea of a vocation. He says, quoting St. Paul, "'Tis no sin for a man to labor in his vocation," and then adds, "My vocation is highway robbery." He arranges for constant carnival instead of Lent. He plays instead of working. Far from the new Protestant ethic, he's something close to the old romantic notion of Merry England, Robin Hood and his merry men in Sherwood Forest, as opposed to the Sheriff of Nottingham and King John. And he's something close to an ethic that has arisen in the late 20th century, the counterculture that got going in the late 60s, that saw its values in personal warmth, in psychological fulfillment, not in asceticism or public duty. An ethic that is founded on a thorough skepticism about the establishment and what the establishment defines as public duty, often in its own self-serving interest. The final confrontation of the lean young prince at the end of part two, when he has just been crowned king, and the fat old knight, is the confrontation between the dedication to public life and the enrichment of private life. Hal rejects Falstaff. That rejection has excited an enormous amount of argument amongst Shakespearean critics. Is he right to do so? Isn't it cruel that he does it? Moreover, the response to the rejection has influenced response to the whole of the two plays. Those who find Hal's rejection of Falstaff, "I know thee not, old man, fall to thy prayers," those who find that rejection a needlessly public and preachy put down of Falstaff, usually also find the whole Lancastrian tribe of kings to be a bunch of cold opportunists. Those who approve the rejection of Falstaff, those who say that Hal must put a stop to the pretensions of this fat old rogue who thinks he has all the laws of England at his commandment, also usually approve of the Lancastrian kings, of their effort to preserve public order under difficult circumstances. Now, the argument over which side to take here, which side Shakespeare meant us to take, has been going on since the beginning of the 18th century, for three centuries now. Any scene that so polarizes audiences for three centuries clearly evokes deep divisions in the human condition, at least the human condition as it has existed in recent Western culture. If one of the functions of myth is to dramatize conflicts that lie at the heart of our culture, then Shakespeare has created a most powerful myth here in this last confrontation between the young king and his old companion. The Protestant ethic, with its devotion to duty and hard work and sobriety and self-sacrifice, confronts warmth, loyalty, merriment, merrymaking, and skepticism about the establishment. And this conflict does indeed govern the two plays. The body politic is supported by all the fictions it generates of kingship, honor, and the common weal. And yet Shakespeare ensures that we know they are fictions. The king himself was once a rebel, and honor is possessed by him that died a Wednesday. What use is it to him? And many, in fact, don't do very well in the common weal. Balancing the body politic is the human body itself, best summed up in Falstaff. Fat, disorderly, appetitive, shrewd, and rich in the fullness of living. Hal, as king of the body politic, must reject Falstaff, the body impolitic. But Shakespeare does not reject Falstaff. Nor does he reject Hal for rejecting Falstaff.